Hello and welcome to the William Carey University College of Medicine Do It Right podcast. We have a great episode ahead of us today. I am Rabia Summer-Rahman, joining here with Jake Passman. We will be your hosts for today's very exciting episode with Dr. Anderson. Students here are very familiar with our guest today, but Jake, would you introduce us to Dr. Anderson?
Yes, of course. Hello, everyone. We are very pumped to be here today, and I'm very pumped to introduce our guest, Dr. Ryan Anderson. He is a board-certified emergency medicine physician through the American Board of Emergency Medicine, who is currently the flight commander and lead ER physician at Keesler Air Force Base in Mississippi. He completed his undergraduate studies at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, and went to medical school at the Edward Via College of Osteopathic Medicine, also in Blacksburg. He is happily married to his wife, Allie, and has three incredible children, Aria, Adam, and Ella. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Man, thank you for the invite. I'll tell you, I love podcasting. I've done several podcasts, and it's an honor to be even considered to be one of you guys' special guests. Certainly the intro, I think, makes me sound more impressive than I am. But man, I do appreciate that intro. And I think you guys have to be one of the few students leading a podcast in your very, very busy medical school curriculum. So good job to you guys. And thanks for having me today.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Anderson. Students here at William Carey are very familiar with you. You not only head our ultrasound program, but also you lecture for us, lead our breakout rooms, offer your board prep course. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Before all of this, you are an emergency medicine physician, and we would love to hear from you. You know, what brought you into medicine? What brought you into emergency medicine as well? And, you know, was EM the specialty you always wanted to pursue going into medical school?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I'm a little, less traditional than probably most. I've been on selection committees for residency programs, and I always remember reading people's personal statements and thinking about how incredible they were, you know. You read so many that they knew that they were going to be a physician since they were like 4 years old. I'm not even sure I formed a thought process while I was 4 years old. But I grew up from in a very military family. I am fifth generation military, and I'm the first generation officer. I'm the first officer in my family. My family was all enlisted, for those military listeners, and there will be several because I interact with them a lot at William Carey. Being in the military to me was actually more important than being a physician. And I don't want to put any dark shadow over being a physician. It is an incredible calling. It is an incredible career. And I'm thankful I ended up here. But when I was younger, it became very apparent to me, unfortunately, my older brother died of suicide, and it is the reason you mentioned I do the breakout groups, and it is the reason I spend a lot of time in the breakout groups talking about mental health and mental well-being and all of those things that I'm so passionate about. But my older brother died, and it became very apparent that my younger brother just wasn't military minded, and that's okay. Not everybody is. Not everybody should be. So I just, from an early standpoint, knew that it was going to be me, knew kind of military was going to be me. And I prepared myself for that. So I went, as you already, thank you again for that awesome introduction. I went to Virginia Tech, and Virginia Tech is considered a senior military college. Virginia Tech used to be all military, actually, and a lot of people don't know that. Its rival school now is UVA, because there are listeners who went to UVA. I make fun of them all the time in your class. But our rival used to be VMI, or Virginia Military Institute, and Virginia Tech was called VPI. And then Virginia Tech got a grant, a land act, and part of that was they had to allow civilian students. And now Virginia Tech is what it is now. It's like I don't know, 28,000 students and only 2,000 military. So pretty interesting. So I set myself up more to be successful military. And then my second year, I do want to just elaborate on this a little bit, because I think now as I get portrayed as some big savant and I've just had a red carpet rolled before me and I got a perfect score on my boards and all the success stories. But this, I'm not going to use bad terms on a podcast. This joker, referring to myself, almost didn't even get into medical school. I was a sophomore in college at Virginia Tech on an ROTC scholarship. I'm very thankful. And part of an ROTC scholarship, because the military already has you, they already own you once you graduate, is if you want to do the HPSP, the Healthcare Profession Scholarship Program, which is how I went to medical school, you have to apply and get approved for in your second year of college. I didn't know what I was doing in second year of college. I don't want to say barely getting by, but I was making like 3.0s, you know, I mean, 3.0s. I wasn't like some stellar 4.0, just knew how he was doing in college. And I say all that to say, part of this application was you had to get a 3.5 in order to get the scholarship. And it came down, this is going to sound like hyperbole for the purpose of a podcast, but it came down to one class, the final semester, I had to get an A. If I got an A, it raised my GPA just above a 3.5. I think it was like a 3.51. And if I got a B on this final, it was below 3.5. I would not have gotten the HPSB scholarship. I would now be a pilot, navigator, whatever in the Air Force. But glory to God, I got an A on that final. And that was the only reason. I got an A. I got a 3.51. And then I got the scholarship, thankfully. And it was that close to forever changing the trajectory of my career. But you guys obviously know I got that A. I got the HPSB scholarship. And then after I went to medical school, also in Blacksburg, Virginia, I applied to one medical school, which is a little abnormal. Thankfully, I had a lot of leadership in at Virginia Tech. And I knew the college was on campus. The osteopathic college was on campus. I knew a lot of people there. They knew my GPA. They knew my MCATs. And they were like, look, you're a walk-on. So I didn't I'm thankful. Thank you, VCOM. I applied to one medical school, got in. I didn't even have to move. It was incredible. And I was on campus for 8 years. And the question, I did really well. That's when I figured out how to study, was in medical school. And to kind of, you talked about the board prep, something that I did in my second year, in my preparation for step one, level one, is I made this massive study schedule, because that's how I learned to study. I went from high school, I was fairly terrible student. College, I figured it out. In med school, I flew. You know, I graduated valedictorian of medical school. I'm very thankful. I just figured out how to study. And that catapulted my career into board prep. And now I'm about to start my 12th year in board prep, which doesn't feel real. I was actually working on stuff for that this morning. You guys are soon getting an email from me, and then I'll go from your favorite professor, hopefully self-proclaimed favorite professor, to your least favorite professor, all in one semester. But I did really, really well. You guys know that. I did really, really well. I created this huge algorithm to help me study and gave myself weekly assignments to make boards, this massive task, to bite-sized chunks, right? And that's kind of where we flourished. I got a perfect score on my level one. And then I started reviewing first aid. And then I went to a different company. I did all that stuff. And I'm very, very blessed to have been able to do that. And then I guess 4 or 5 years ago, I don't even know at this point, it's all a blur and it all runs together, I decided to start my own company called Conquering the Board, which has been a phenomenal adventure, helping literal hundreds of students every year successfully conquer their boards. But actually in medical school, I got to get back to your actual original question. In pure ER form, I have jumped down the rabbit hole head first and my legs are dangling out. But in medical school, I actually thought I was going to be a pediatrician. I love pediatrics. To this day, I still love pediatrics. I love pediatric emergencies. They're some of my favorite cases, some of my favorite memories of saving a young kid's life. It just doesn't get any better. But I did my rotation. It was in third year. Third year, I thought I was going to be pediatrics. I did a hybrid outpatient inpatient pediatrics that also had NICU. And man, I learned, I hated, sorry for the listeners who love it, I hated outpatient medicine. It just always felt like a time crunch. And, you know, there's certain patients where you can spend 5 minutes with them and that's totally fine. You know, they're just like, hey, I'm fine. I'm here for a checkup. I need my immunizations. And they're out the door and you're like, hey, see you next year. All good. And there's certain patients that need more time. There's certain patients that need 30 minutes of your time, 45 minutes of your time. And I just felt an outpatient, it didn't give me that flexibility. Now, some people will fight me and they'll say, well, now in this clinic, they have 30-minute time slots. Okay, sure. But I was working in a clinic where it's 15-minute time slots and I hated it. I hated it. I think there's always a pressure to see more patients. And I think when you try to cram in more patients, I don't care if you're the best doctor ever. And I'm even speaking about myself, not as the best doctor ever, not as myself. But when you try to cram in more patients, you decrease quality time with patients. And I'm guilty of that. Anybody who does that is guilty of that. And I hated it. And then I thought I was going to do internal medicine. I love internal medicine, the inpatient internal medicine, again, not the outpatient. And I was actually on an audition at Kiesler, where I am now, at Kiesler Medical Center. I auditioned there as a fourth year internal medicine. And we had a few cases because we were doing inpatient only where we had to go to the ER, right? It was like a good stroke and we had to go to the ER and do our assessments. And the ER had already done everything. They already gotten the CAT scan. They had already given the medications. They had already treated the stroke. And then I was like, well, what are we doing? And we would admit them and we would order, you know, the angiograms, you know, the CTA head and neck. And we ordered the echo and we would do all that stuff. And I was like, well, like the treatment's been done. And it was actually during that audition, and this is a bold move, don't recommend, at every audition, you interview with the program director. If it's a good program, they'll just say, hey, you can interview while you're here. I'm going to save your time. If they don't do that, I know all the good programs do that. And I actually sat down in front of this program director and I said, sir, I said, it was your program that made me realize I wanted to do emergency medicine. And he was like, absolutely bewildered. He was like, this is internal medicine. I was like, I know. I was like, I'm not interested in your program. I am so sorry. But thank you so much for helping me realize I wanted to do emergency medicine. So then, and this for all the fourth year listeners, and all of you will soon be fourth years. So it'll fly by. You are not married to something just because you think you want to do it. And you've done 1,000 rotations. I did this is hyperbole. I did 3 dermatology rotations. When you get a perfect score on your boards, all your friends say, you know what you should do? Dermatology. So I did like 3 or 4 dermatology rotations and I loved it. I loved it. I love dermatology. And it was my fourth year when everything had been set up. All my auditions had been set up that I decide I'm going to completely change trajectories. I mean, my academic counselor, who I keep up with now, I must have driven her absolutely bonkers because I went from I want to do pediatrics to I want to do internal medicine, from I want to do critical care medicine, from I want to do dermatology to hold on. I know I'm graduating in 6 months. I want to do emergency medicine. And I was out of emergency medicine rotations. So I had to get crafty. I did surgical rotations and did anesthesia and then just worked in the ER at night. And that's a message for the listeners. What you need to do, and I say this all the time in breakouts, so let me say it here on the podcast. The best thing you can do as a medical student, right now, commit to boards. Not right now. Have a great Thanksgiving. Or maybe I wasn't supposed to say Thanksgiving because we're kind of doing a weird recording here. But have a great holiday season. And then commit to board study. That's the best thing you can do as a second year. First year, don't do anything for boards. It's nonsense that you tell me you've read first that you haven't done anything. Second years, you got to commit 6 months, essentially, 4 or 5 months, to hardcore, uncomfortable studying. And then you can be done with it, you know? And then as a third and fourth year, you need to figure out how to be helpful, how to be present. It's the most important thing you can do. I have a student rotating with me right now who's one of the best. She's weird. She's like a second/third year, just because she comes from a school that does things different. She is one of the best students I've ever had, ever. And she's in the room doing IVs. She's in there getting EKGs. She's in there taking patients to CAT scan, which I've never seen a student ever do ever. But she's present and she's helpful. And she's going to be successful no matter what she does. That's the best thing you can do as a medical student. And then what I did, this is legitimately, I went to, you didn't mention where I did residency because I didn't tell you. I did residency at Lehigh Valley Health Network in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I did a civilian residency program at a level 1 trauma center. How did I get there? I was out of ER rotations. I went there and said, hey, I want to do anesthesia during the day, which would help me as an ER doctor, doing intubations, doing procedural sedations, doing nerve blocks, doing all that stuff. And then when I was done with my anesthesia day, you know what I did? I walked down to the ER. I introduced myself to whoever's on shift and said, I'm the med student working with you tonight. It sucked. I was working like 16 to 18 hour days. But you know where I got into residency? My first choice, Lehigh Valley Health Network, Allentown, Pennsylvania. And I'm thankful. But for that month, man, I worked 16 to 18 hour days and just showed them, hey, I'm committed. This is where I'm going to come. And this is the work ethic you're getting with me being here. Holy smokes, that was a long answer. I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, that all sounds good, Dr. Anderson. So I wanted to ask you about your military background. And for those of us that do not know exactly what a flight commander is, could you just explain that and explain your specific role in the military and how you made your way towards that?
Yeah, great question. So flight commander just sounds fancy. It has nothing to do with flight at all. The military breakdown in the Air Force is at your lowest level, you have what's called flights. That's a group of about 50. I have 52 people, and we have an emergency department flight. So all staff of the emergency department are called the emergency services flight. I had 52 members in that flight, and I'm the commander of that flight. So that's why they call me the flight commander. I'm the number one. So I'm responsible for the physicians, the nurses, and all the medics. Making sure their credentialing is all together, making sure their ambulance driver's license are all together, because I don't just have technicians. All my technicians are medics, so they come with certifications that they have to maintain. So really, I'm the civilian equivalent would be a department chair or department head is kind of what I am. I'm above the medical director, which is where you see a lot of, you know, the physician trajectory. Even on the civilian side, you'll be a physician, you'll grind. You'll be the medical director in charge of the department, but you'll still be working physician. And then usually after medical director, you go to department head. So I'm the department head of that. So my day to day, kind of what you asked, is I do about 50% of my time administratively doing all of that stuff, time cards, making sure people get paid, all that weird administrative stuff, and have a great staff, great help. And I do the other 50% clinical. So I work a lot of hours a week, but essentially I do 20 hours a week admin, and then I do 24 hours a week clinical. And then on my off time, I spend with you guys. So I average about somewhere between 55 to 60 hours of work a week.
Got it. Well, that all sounds good. So I wanted to pivot a little and just ask about ultrasound. As us as William Carey students, we all know that you have an immense passion for ultrasound. And I'm just curious where that all stems from.
Yeah. So, I love being the ultrasound director at William Carey. It is it's tied with boards. But it is the job that I have that gives me the most, just internal satisfaction, to see you guys come with zero ultrasound knowledge and experience, to put you through the curriculum and to get these success stories that I get from third and fourth year students. Of, I just got one recently. It was like, hey, I was the only one in my entire group, attending, resident, intern, other medical students who knew how to identify a pneumonia on ultrasound. And I get those all the time. You guys will send me those. And it is incredible. But one thing specifically, I mentioned Lehigh Valley Health Network emergency residency program. It is a 4-year residency program. And whereas ER is traditionally 3 years. But that fourth year, I spent being a chief resident, which I'm thankful for. That was early experience to the administrative stuff that is helping me now do really well as the department head. But the other thing is they got a little bit, there's an extra year, so they have a lot more leeway. There's more pediatrics time, which I was thankful for. But there's a whole ultrasound curriculum. And more than that, my program took it a step further and did ultrasound certification. So I was able to get my emergency critical care ultrasound certification. And where it all started at William Carey, I am thankful for your dean. I am a big fan of Dean Subarow, and he knows it. And when I was a chief resident, part of what we would do is we would coordinate Grand Rounds and Grand Rounds speaker. You guys will soon know Grand Rounds very intimately. You have Grand Rounds every week as a resident where you guys all get together and it's kind of lecture based. You go, you'll give the lectures, you'll receive the lectures. Sometimes it's hands-on procedures, simulations. But once a month, we would have a large Grand Rounds where we would have a guest speaker. And lo and behold, one of those guest speakers in my fourth year was Dr. Italo Subirao. And he came talking about his drone technology. You know, he's big into drone technology and kind of medical supply delivery through drones. And he came and gave that lecture. And I went up to him. I had already known I was going to be at Kiser Medical Center. And I said, hey, you said you're from somewhere in Mississippi. It was Hattiesburg. I just didn't know Mississippi at the time. I'm going to, I think, Biloxi, Mississippi. Is that close? And he was like, dude, that's an hour away. I don't think he said, dude, I'm paraphrasing. He said, that's an hour away. And he gave me his card and said, once you get there, hit me up. We'll get coffee. Coffee turned into Italian. I don't know how. It was delicious. And he offered me a spot on the family medicine kind of department. And that's how I started. I just started as adjunct faculty for the family medicine department and would just help with need help. I would show up for the first years when they were doing physical exam skills. I would show up for the second years when you guys were doing simulation or breakouts or SPs or hands-on skills procedures. And then I would come to your ultrasound, which you guys will know what I'm referencing. It was done in the Thomas Building, which it still is, but it was done not in the OMT because we hadn't developed an agreement with OMT at the time, the OPP faculty. But it was done in those middle exam rooms now where you do the SP encounters. And what we would do, and you've seen them, we would take either the CART ultrasounds, the big clunky ultrasounds, or we had these Phillips probes. And we would shove one into a room, and then we would put about six students in that room. It would get disgusting, hot and sweaty, muggy in those rooms. But at the end of the 30 minutes or 45 minutes that you were given in there, you would be lucky to have maybe 5 minutes of probe time. And then the students were leaving. I mean, you guys can relate. You've already done, you're doing the program. Like, think about how it would be if you got 5 minutes of probe time. It would be useless. And it was useless. They were leaving having known nothing. And we were patting our back saying, hey, we're doing this ultrasound thing and we're doing it well. And I approached Dean Subirao and was like, dude, like, we've got to teach these. I did not say dude. I don't know why dude is stuck in my brain. I would obviously say, sir. And I said, we're not doing ultrasound right. And these students are suffering because of it. And as the years have progressed, it was, hey, you're going to learn ultrasound as an attending. And then it was, well, the residencies need to teach you ultrasound. And it was like, well, the medical students, our school should be teaching you ultrasounds. That way, when you get on rotations, you know what you're doing with ultrasound. And I was like, we're just under preparing our students for ultrasound. And he gave me the green light. And I spent a summer interviewing companies, and I had companies come to William Carey and demonstrate their product. And we landed on Butterfly as kind of to meet our needs. And now you guys see it. It's a nice plug and play 3-in-1 probe in which you can easily change the probe type. Now, that'll be a little different when you get on clinical rotations, and you'll have to learn how to switch probe types. And your preceptor hopefully will be able to tell you how to do that. But it's a nice learner probe. That's a nice, I use it as an attending. So I just didn't say a learner. It's a nice point of care probe where you can just plug and play. And for you guys, it comes with the Butterfly Academy. So you can do kind of a teaching before you come to the lab. You guys know I always do a quick little info session and then we just scan. And when we did that 2-hour lab, the fast, I mean, you guys got like an hour and a half of scan time. Right. I would say about an hour and a half. So it went from 5 minutes of scan time to about an hour and a half of scan time, you know, which is just incredible. And you guys are the quality is just showing of how great it is. And I'll say it. We're the only school doing it. We're the only school doing ultrasound certification. And that is what I'm passionate about because it makes you more competitive as a resident. When you show up and it's on your CV, ultrasound certified and point of care ultrasound, and then you show them their certification and they reach out to me and say, hey, tell me what this is about. And then I send them all your archived images and they're like, what? Like these fast exams are from this student? Like, absolutely, you know? And not all of your images are good. Trust me, I've graded, I think I just looked, 14,000 images already in one semester. They should all be graded, hopefully, unless you guys have uploaded more and then I'll cry. But I think we're up to 14,000 images and it's nice. I like it. I can see your bad images. I can see your decent images. And then towards the end, I'm like, holy smokes, these are incredible images. And then you guys know you have a skills assessment coming up in April, but it's just awesome to make you guys more competitive. But even more important than that, it's making you better physicians, especially knowing that a lot of you are going to go into primary care. A probe that you can buy and plug and play and make real life-saving point of care interventions and diagnoses right then and there is what it's all about.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask one more question about ultrasound, and this is more about your outlook on the future of ultrasound. As everyone knows, every doctor carries a stethoscope around in their pocket. Do you think there will ever be a time in the future where it will be like that with the plug and play ultrasounds that like we use that you hook up to your phone, where every doctor will just carry one around and be able to easily hook it up to their phone and diagnose right there?
Yeah, I think that time is now, honestly. Now, maybe not every doctor has their own, but there was a time not too long ago where I work in a lot of remote places. I love it. I like working in community hospitals. I like the thrill of being alone and not having much support and doing it on my own and pushing myself. I like that. And it's because I'm still relatively young. And as I age in emergency medicine, I'm sure I will like that less and less. But there was a time in some of these community hospitals where there was no ultrasound, which was mind-blowing. As a guy who was certified in ultrasound, it was mind-blowing. But now I'll tell you, there is not an ER you'll walk in that doesn't have an ultrasound. So yes, maybe not everybody has one dangling around their waist or in their pocket. But certainly, especially emergency medicine, the number of doctors that don't know how to use ultrasound or have access to ultrasound is just declining. Now, of course, the older physicians that still work in the emergency department, they still don't grab the probe. They're traditional. They're stubborn. It's okay. But as you know, this generation is coming up, you guys, and even me, we just know how to do ultrasound. So we're quick to grab it. You know, I'm quick to do an echo. I don't need to order a formal echo. I'll just do my own echo, as you guys have done, to rule out right then and there a massive PE or a cardiac tamponade, or I'll throw it in the lungs to evaluate for a pneumothorax or interstitial edema or pleural effusion. Whereas traditionally that would require an X-ray or a CAT scan or a formal ultrasound. I can make that diagnosis in minutes, where it would take them hours. And I still see that actively in the ER. I still see that. And do the patients suffer? Usually not. But there are some patients that present acutely ill, and they will decline within an hour. So to be able to make that diagnosis in minutes as opposed to an hour plus is what saves lives. And that's what I'm passionate about. But I think that time is really now. You're seeing that time now. There's schools, and we're not one of them, and I don't know if we should be. There's schools doing one-to-one probes. So when you graduate with the butterfly probe. You guys are like, of course we should. Not all of you are going to use ultrasound, right? Not all of you are going to use ultrasound. So those of you that are listening that say, of course I'm going to use ultrasound, right? All of you think you're going to use OPP. You just do. And then when you're going to get out in the real world, some of you just aren't going to use those principles. I hope you do. But as an emergency medicine physician, I'll tell you, I don't do OPP clinically. I don't have time to do OPP clinically. My patients are generally emergent. I don't prioritize that. And some of you aren't going to prioritize an ultrasound. Those of you who go on to be ophthalmologists just aren't going, well, I say that. And now ocular ultrasound is massive. I don't know. Maybe you guys are all going to use ultrasound. But neurosurgeons, there we go. Neurosurgeons probably are never going to use ultrasound. And that's okay for that line of work.
Ultrasound certification is definitely a boost for our residency applications and also a great tool as a physician. But boards is also a huge factor. And you spoke a bit about your board prep course that second years will be taking part in. Starting this December, but can you tell us more about how it's structured and how students should expect to get out of it?
So my board prep company starts from passion. Let me say that. It just starts from a place of absolute passion. I don't make nearly as much money as I put into that program. But it is a labor of love. And what I do, my passion lies. And the reason I've already said that I got into this is because I got a perfect score on my board exams. It just became passionate. I used to send that Excel sheet that I made, which is almost essentially what I have now. It just, I've done so much more. I've done 12 years of research to make sure I'm giving you guys the highest quality of resources, because there are some bad resources out there. I won't name them on the podcast, but in person, I'll tell you all the bad resources. All the resources are the ones I endorse. I don't get paid by any of them, so I can endorse them without any guilt. Are on my website, www.conqueringtheboards.com. And it changes between step one and step two. First aid for the USMLE step two is garbage. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't use names on this podcast. It is just not a good resource for step two. So I help through my 12 years of knowledge kind of really make sure you're studying the most high yield. And that comes from a place of frustration. I'll tell you, when I was in medical school, we were made to use a program that was pretty bad. And that's where the passion of my program really developed. I would send people my Excel sheet for years and years and years, and they would take it and they would do well. And then the design of it, this is the question you asked. Let me get back to the question you asked, is I send weekly assignments, either 26 weeks, 16 weeks. I have a 9 week, I have a 4 week. I have all kinds, you know, depending on students' needs. And I've had students with weird requests. You know, they're like, I'm getting married and I want to leave for a honeymoon, or I want spring break off. Nobody gets spring break off, by the way. I don't do big assignments, and you guys are completely fine to do an assignment during spring break. But I send you weekly assignments the day before you're supposed to start them. And then I just let you figure out how that fits in your day. So some people, for instance, week one is read 10 pages of first aid a day. And do a very few questions, do 100 questions. It's easy. Week one's easy. And some people are like, well, I don't want to read 10 pages a day. I want a day off. So they read 12 pages a day. That's fine. It doesn't matter. And they do 12 pages a day and they get a day off. So I do weekly assignments to give people a lot more flexibility in their week. I don't believe in daily assignments. I won't do daily assignments. I think it constricts your day too much. If you got a big test to study for or something like that, it doesn't give you enough flexibility. And I don't believe in monthly assignments just because it feels overwhelming, right? If I give you 4 weeks of assignments, it just feels like a massive weight. And I don't want it to feel like a massive weight. I want it to feel like small, bite-sized chunks. The low and slow method, the board studying, will help you retain it when you're on rotations. Because the stuff that you are expected to know on USMLE step one and on Comlex level one are the stuff that you're expected to know on rotations. That's the stuff you're going to get quizzed on and pimped, if you will, while you're on rotations. And that's what I'm passionate about. I told you right from the podcast, I just recorded your delirium lecture. And it's funny that I'm not throwing shade. I am throwing shade. I'm just going to do so very cautiously. The delirium lecture, this is my first year giving a delirium lecture, which I think it should be an ER doctor. We see delirium first and we treat delirium first. Last year was like 64 slides. Okay. And 64 slides. In first aid, delirium is, I'll say, a fourth of a page. Right? So you don't need 64 slides about delirium when to the level that you're expected to know right now is a quarter of a page. So, hey, newsflash, you're welcome. Your delirium lecture is 25 slides. That's it. And it's all high yield. And I even screenshotted first aid, bits of first aid, and put it in there. So you can see what I expect you to know and then what boards expect you to know. It's not vastly different. I expect you to know a little bit more. Of course I do. You know, that's what I'm passionate about is getting you guys the high yield material. And I do that through a very, very strategic weekly assignment that in the beginning, 45 to 60 minutes a day for the first about 10 weeks. Then it goes up a little bit to about maybe an hour and a half a day. As we get closer, we have to. And then I just leave it at an hour and a half a day until you're done with finals. I let you take finals off if you don't want to study anything during finals. Well, study anything. Study for finals. And then after finals, I just obliterate you. And it's awesome. We do 9 to 11 hours a day. And that's fine. I mean, that's nothing, right? I mean, the grand scheme of you have nothing else to do other than boards. 9 to 11 hours is not that bad. So for the fast students, it'll be 9. For the slower students, it'll be 11. And some students, honestly, you think 9 to 11, you're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to do that. But all you have to do is board study. And I get a lot of students who add to it. They finish early and they're like, I'm going to do more. And they'll do an Aki deck. You know, they'll make an Aki deck of stuff that they frequently miss. One of my most successful students who just graduated last year was an ambassador of Conquering the Boards. That's what he did. He made an Aki deck of everything he kept forgetting. He made an Aki deck. So when he finished my daily assignments, his evening was just going through his Aki deck of stuff he kept forgetting. Every time he missed a question, the same question, he just made an Aki deck out of essentially the question and the answer. And man, he smoked it. He beat me. I'm not mad to say it. I loved it. He beat me on level 2. He got a higher score than I did, which is hard to do. I got a perfect score on my Comlex 1. I got the highest score in the nation on my Comlex 3. My Comlex 2, I got a 760. He got like a 780, which was awesome. I was stoked for him. I took him out and bought him a drink. That's how stoked I was. So that's kind of the design of my board prep program.
That was a really open-ended question, and I can't handle open-ended questions.
Hey, that was perfect. That was perfect. This one's not as open-ended as the previous question, but with Comlex 1 and Step 1 going pass, fail, what's your opinion?
This is a setup.
What's your opinion on taking just Comlex for us or taking both of them? I know it's dependent on how competitive of a specialty you want to go into. You get what I'm asking.
Yeah, holy smokes. I wish we knew the answer. I wish the answer was set in stone, but we don't. And why don't we? It's because the Comlex in the USMLE step level 1 just recently went to pass-fail. You guys know this. Yep. And there's not enough data to know that answer. Even as the board review guy. And I've been into boards longer than most, right? Most people in my seat. I don't know. But what I am seeing, and I won't drop any names, of course. The unfortunate reality is if you sit for both Comlex 1, USMLE 1, very similar test. They both have their pros and cons. And it's actually very interesting. About 50% of students will say the USMLE is easier, and then 50% of students will say the Comlex is easier. That's really bizarre to me every year. I don't know why. I have no answer for that. But the worst reality of it is you pass Comlex and you fail USMLE. Because, listeners, listen to me now. There is some misinformation on the SDN, the Student Doctor Network, saying if you fail USMLE, you don't have to report it. Okay? That's false. I've reached out to the match board, right? The people who govern that decision. It is considered a violation. If you do not report a test that you took, it's considered a violation. So if you take USMLE and you fail, you have to either report the failure or you have to retake it. And pass fail, it's not needed. USMLE 1 is not needed for you guys. You have to, per your curriculum, because you're in an osteopathic medical school. And when I work with allopathic students, they don't even have this dilemma. And it's like, it's unfair. It's unfair that you guys have this dilemma and they don't when your curriculums are identical, right? It's very upsetting. I'm a DO, so I can get passionate about that. Because they don't have this dilemma. They're just like, I'm going to take this one test and it's going to be all fine. And you guys have this dilemma. But now all Comlex and USMLE level step 1 is it is a pass fail. It is a safety stop of saying you are safe to go see and interact with patients. There's no score, there's no stratification. Whereas, and this is where I will differ, step 2, level 2 now is your stratifier. Okay? So if you are going into competitive specialty, okay? Or if you are very particular about where you end up, like this is my one residency, I want to go here and I don't want to go anywhere else. And you look at, I always tell people, log on to the website because you can hit meet our residents. That's usually the button, meet our residents. And I would look at the two letters at the end of their name. And if you see MD, 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 and there's no DOs, the odds are stacked against you. Whether you take USMLE or not. Because if they don't respect your Comlex, they don't respect your letters, okay? And that's a malignant program, that's a dying program, and I wouldn't be caught dead in that program, okay? And that's exactly how I would explain it. Here's the comma, right? Here's the however, okay? If they are traditionally heavier allopathic, and that is your spot, you're like, I can't go anywhere else. Maybe your spouse is in the hospital. I don't know, whatever the situation is. You can't go anywhere else. I would just take USMLE. I'm going to prepare you for both of them, should you decide to do my program. And let me say, my program is a way, not the way, okay? Some people love it and they follow it like it's biblical truth. It is not biblical truth, but that's how closely they follow it. Other people take my program and they adopt it. They adapt it. And they're like, I don't really want to read this style. I want to read this style. Like the first 10 weeks, I shouldn't say this on the podcast. The first 10 weeks of my program is optional. I have a 26-week program and a 16-week program. My 16-week program is actually the most popular program, but I just offer your school pays for the 16-week program, but I just give them the 26-week program as a fist bump, attaboy, appreciate you. But the first 10 weeks is optional, and all I have you do, and you guys stress. You guys are medical students. You stress about nothing. I even say, don't memorize any of this. I have you read first aid. That's it, like a book. Like a book. And you're like, I don't get anything out of it. You do. What you get out of it is you start appreciating what's high yield and what's not high yield. And I'll challenge the three of you in this room. Sorry, Seth, you've been a silent entity so far. The three of you in this room, you don't know what high yield is. I know you don't know what high yield is. You may think you know what high yield is. And I'm here as the board guy to say you don't know what high yield is. Because not everything in your lectures is high yield. Some of it's, you know, kind of first aid plus. And that's important. It's important. We don't teach the first aid. We have to at least teach first aid, but we don't teach to first aid. We need to give you more as well. So that's all it is. I recommend it. You'll see. I recommend it. You do it with a partner, accountability partner of me and my accountability partner. Still keep in touch to this day. He's actually incredible. He's like the only pediatric cardiologist in the Air Force. I did beat him on boards, Dwight, talking to you. You'll never listen to the podcast, but, or maybe I will. Maybe I'll send it to him when you push it out.
Yeah, just send him the link.
But he was my study buddy, and we met up every day during lunch, and that was the only hour we committed. We met up every day during lunch, and we read 10 pages of first aid a day. And we didn't try to memorize it. We read it out loud, right, so that we were saying it and hearing it, right, two different learning styles. We weren't taking notes, we weren't memorizing, but we would meet up every day and read 10 pages of first aid. And that's all I asked you to do. Hey, there we go. I'm giving you the cheat code. That's the first 10 weeks of my program. I say, find a partner, read it out loud, let it become habit. Spend 45 to 60 minutes a day and get in the habit of dedicating time for board review.
Maybe you can start a first aid book club sometime.
Yeah. The William Carey First Aid Book Club.
I'll tell you, hey, this isn't out yet. William Carey just renewed, so you guys will have my platform. I have some very exciting stuff to talk about in our breakout today because I've been helping shape some curriculum development for next semester. So really excited about that.
Awesome, awesome. So we've talked about the ultrasound certification that us as William Carey students will have after all of this. Talked about your board program. What else, what other advice would you give to us and everyone else out there to be the most competitive student applying to residency whenever we do that?
Yeah. This is where I'm gonna take the road less traveled, okay? You got to prioritize yourself. And for those that are in my small group, or my breakout group, whatever we're going to call it next semester, our fun club, I talk about this a lot. Mental health and mental well-being is number one. It has to be number one. You have to be number one. Because if you don't take care of yourself, you're just not going to be you. And what we want, and I say we because I've sat on the board of residency programs, is at a certain point, I don't care about your GPA. I don't care about your class rank. I don't care about your scores. That will get you in the door. All those things will get you in the door to an interview or a rotation spot. And then after that, I care about the person. I care about people coming in early. I care about people asking good questions. I did not say I care about people asking questions. They say that there's no such thing as a dumb question. There is something as a not well thought out question, okay?
Okay.
Asking questions just to ask questions is annoying. It's annoying. Yeah. But asking good, well thought questions of genuine desire to learn is easily seeable. And that's what I want. And I know that's what the residency program want because I sat on the board of accepting the residency. And the story wasn't you had a 3.8, you had a 3.9, let's go with you. The story was you showed up early and stayed late and asked good questions. I had to call you in from home on two shifts. Let's go with the one who's reliable.
Gotcha. So you're not looking for just some robot that's got the best stats to come in and do everything. You're looking at the whole person and who they are, their work ethic.
Not just me, everybody.
Or everybody, yes. Yep.
That's what it's all about. Are you going to be helpful? You guys know, I've talked about that in lecture. You got to find a way to be helpful. Maybe it's helping your nurses. Medical students mess this up so many times. They act as if they are better than the nurse. You are not better than anyone. And you got to do the grunt work. I'm the flight commander of the ER. You know what I did today? You know what I did before coming in this morning? I went to Keesler on my day off because our call roster was incorrect. And they tried to call a few people around the hospital, and my roster, my call cheat sheet was wrong. So I went in this morning on my day off. I updated the call roster, printed out 20 copies, laminated them all, and put them next to every phone. You know what that is? Scut work. Why should I, as number one of 52 people, have to do that? I don't have to do it. I want to do it because I'm not above that job, right? And as students, as residents, as even attending physicians, you are not above doing a job. If a patient defecates on themselves, you're not above helping clean up the mess. And man, medical school students miss this all the time. And the second the nurses dislike you, you're done to that program. So you should be asking the nurse, what can I do to help you? Can I do the next IV? Can I do the next Foley catheter? You'll realize nurses do more procedures than the doctors. So if you want procedures, which is what you should want as a medical school or student, you need to sweeten the pot for the nurse, right? Because you want to do IVs, you want to do Foleys, you want to do OGs, NG tubes, right? Whatever they, I mean, there are so many procedures that they do. You want to do all this. So where I see a lot of medical students really mess themselves up is they're like, I'm not going to help clean that bed or put a sheet on that bed. Why not? I've done it. I do it routinely. And if I'm not above it, no offense, you guys aren't above it, you know? So right. That means so much. And I have been on the board. Man, I could give a name of a person right now who is an incredible doctor. And she had terrible scores, terrible board scores. And I remember being on this board and everybody was like, I don't know. And I said, she's the one we want. She shows up early. She stays late. The patients love her. The staff love her. She's done 25 procedures because the nurse lets her do everything. EKGs, glucoses, IVs. I said, she's the one we want. You know what? She showed up. She was chief resident. She passed her ABIM boards first time, and she's a credible ER doc. Numbers are not a defining factor. I'm not going to lie. They get your foot in the door. I can't. There's no way around it. I mean, your numbers will get you in the door. And then it's up to you for the rest. Certainly, you can do all the things you're supposed to. You want to get a publication if you can, right? You want to be involved in research. You want to get this ultrasound certification. I do have a fear, listeners, that there's going to be a lot of people in your class that don't get the certification. I do have that fear based off of our ultrasound reviews. Let me give the shout outs to the third years. That was the first class in which everybody got certified. Nice job. But I do have a bit of a fear. We do have a meeting coming up. I think it's next week, right? Next Tuesday, I think, which needs to be mandatory, where we're going to talk about boards. We're going to get our minds right because my program starts in December. It doesn't matter if you're ready or not. It's coming for you. So getting the ultrasound certification, and then you got to commit to boards. It is 6 months of being a little uncomfortable. Really not true. It's about 2 months of being uncomfortable. 6 months of study and 2 months of being really uncomfortable that will dictate your future. Because if you do well in step one, and the reason my program is designed to be 26 weeks, low and slow, it's just like making a good brisket, right? You don't rush a brisket. Because if you rush a brisket, it's going to wind up dry, all right? And nobody has ever gone to a cookout saying, man, I hope that brisket is dry. And nobody ever, right?
Right.
And nobody wants a medical student who just tries to rush through studying for boards and then forgets it all. And I say that as a guy, I offer a boot camp version of my program. It's 5 weeks, it may be 4 weeks. I got to look at it. you can tell I've been out of the game. Our board review is December to July, and then we take off and we veg out. And I say we have it's three of us. But we just kind of veg out for a little bit. I think it's a 4-week program, which will get you to pass. I mean, 100%. I've never had anybody do it and fail. I've never had anybody do my program and fail. And that is still true. But you'll dump it all. You'll commit to 4 weeks. It'll be 12 to 13 hour days. You'll hate everything for a solid month. But you'll pass your boards. The issue is then you'll dump it all. And then you'll get on rotations and you'll be like, I don't remember any of this. Because that's not the way we learn. We learn low and slow. We learn by repetition. It doesn't matter what your learning style is, whether it's visual, whether it's sitting in a lecture, whether it's writing it down, whatever that is. Whatever your style is, you do it repetitively. If you learn by writing it down, you write it down multiple times until it's in your brain. If you're an Anki lover and you love flashcards, you make flashcards until you've got it down and they eventually disappear off your deck, right? Or if you listen to lectures and you're a Pathoma lover, you just listen to that same lecture over and over and over and over again and maybe you make notes. It doesn't matter how you learn. It matters that you do it repetitively. So, but you got to take care of your own brain. I talk about it a lot in small group. I talk about suicide. I come from suicide. My older brother committed suicide. I told you we lost him to mental health. So I'm passionate about that. And you can only be at your peak performance if you're taking care of your brain. Now that's whether you're studying for boards. That's whether you're on wards as a medical student, intern, resident, or whether you're an attending. You got to take care of yourself. You got to prioritize you because your patients depend on it. You can't be in the hole of depression and offer good medical care. I don't believe that's true. So we talk a lot about in small group, you know, taking care of yourself. I make my small group every week. We go around the table. Sometimes it takes a long time, but I commit to it. And we go around the table and we say, what's one thing you did for yourself the week before? You have to carve out time for you. Even when it gets busy, you have to carve out time for you. The studies are clear. Your risk, you three sitting with me right now, your risk of suicide is higher because you're sitting here in medical school. It's a fact. You want to talk about it? Let's talk about it.
Yeah, I was about to say, right? We're already kind of talking about mental health, so let's go right on with that.
And becoming a physician, you know, being well-rounded, being prepared for boards, being well-rounded for residency, you know, it takes a lot out of us. And, you know, you mentioned that if you're not taking care of yourself, how will you be a well-rounded physician and doctor? And how will you be able to take care of someone else if you're not being able to take care of yourself? And being a part of your small group, I really appreciated the opportunity to really not even just share, but even think about, you know, what am I doing for myself? Because if I look at my planner, I'm like, I have this to do for micro, this to do yep. for farm, but what in my schedule am I doing for myself? So for those who aren't in your small group or don't have anyone to reach out to in terms of their mental health, what advice would you give for students who are, especially for OMS2s, who are so stressed about boards yep. coming up, they probably don't have, they think they don't have the time to work on themselves. What advice would you give to them?
Yeah, find your guy. I mean that as a gender neutral term. Find your person. And I'm not necessarily talking about a significant other. Obviously, you're married. I'm married. I'm not talking about necessarily a spouse or a fiance or girlfriend. I'm talking about like your confidant. And sure, my wife is my confidant. I tell my wife everything. But I also have my guy. And I've always had somebody in that role. Now it's shifted, right? Sometimes your guy, and I'm doing that in air quotes, guys, just because you can't see, because it can be a girl. I'm not saying anything like that. But mine is a male. And I think it probably should be the same gender, especially if you're in a serious relationship. I'm not trying to get any guys in trouble. Don't make your person a female. Anyways, yeah, get off track, you know, rabbit hole. but you got to find your person. And, you know, in medical school, I had a person. I mentioned him, Dwight. We met up all the time, once a day for boards. But then we would routinely meet up and have food, you know, break bread, and just talk about that. Talk about how much that micro test sucked, you know, and completely, you know, floored us. Because there is something comforting knowing I'm not the only one. Imposter syndrome is a real thing. So if I bomb that micro exam and I think I'm alone on an island, the only one who bombed it, I'm like, I'm doomed, right? But if I go up to Dwight and he was like, whoa, mama, that thing smoked me. I'm like, all right, not too bad. Maybe we'll get a curve, you know, like whatever the case may be. But it's nice having that person. I had that person all the way through. Or sometimes it was more than one person. But I'll tell you, as an attending, who generally my mindset is good, I still have that person. I have my guy. And I call him every day, every day. I call this guy. He's not in medicine. I think it's very important for me for them not to be in medicine. Now, in medical school, it was helpful for them to be in medical school. For residency, it was helpful because they get it. But now as an attending, I found myself actually wanting the opposite. I want somebody that I can just say, man, I had a terrible case, and them not try to dissect it with me or anything like that. Just saying, hey, it sounds like you did the best you could. He doesn't know any better. But man, it makes me feel better. He's like, hey, you did a better job than me, you know? I'm like, all right, thanks, bud. It's having, and I call him religiously every day. And it's not a long phone call. Sometimes it's 5 minutes. Sometimes we're on the phone for an hour. It just kind of depends on our days. And there's times where he's been down and I've lifted him up. There's been times where I've been down and he's lifted me up. There's been times we've both been up. There's been times when we've both been down. But just having that person to walk with, that accountability person, and they need to share your beliefs. They have to share your beliefs and your ideals. And should your accountability person not share the same beliefs, that would not work. They have to be someone grounded, very similar to where you are. But that's how I do it. And you got to be purposeful. You have to purposely take time out in your week, in your, maybe it's not every day. Personally, for me, it's not every day. I mean, I'm busy. I work more now than I did as a resident, more than I did as an intern, more than I did as a medical student. But I still take time. On the weekends, me and my son will go fishing, or you know, me and my family will go do something. Or maybe it's nothing. Maybe we just sit on the couch and watch football together or watch a movie. I was fortunate. I put a movie theater upstairs. My family loves watching movies. We had a big, great room that was like a second living room. I was like, let's turn it into a movie theater. So I painted the walls all black, put movie posters up, put stadium seating, put a massive projector. And now sometimes we don't go out and do anything. We go upstairs. I bought one of the sweet old school popcorn makers. We pop popcorn. We turn the lights. I put a dimmer in there so it feels like a movie theater. We dim the lights and we just sit there and watch a movie, you know. And family time for me is huge. It's a big time of kind of getting rebalanced and refocused. And it doesn't matter what your thing is. You know, in small group, people go around and like, I ran... Well, somebody said last week, I ran 30 miles. I was like, oh, like that would make me depressed. You know, I get depressed thinking about it. But that's their thing. That's their relief. And runners who love running, they will all tell you that. You know, that release of endorphins is like kind of what balances them. I remember in medical school is the only time I've ever had a panic attack. I had multiple panic attacks. I don't know why. I was just up studying late one night. I never did all-nighters. And then I found myself just the way, and I'm sure you can relate. I found myself sometimes the way tests fell, I would inevitably be up late or doing an all-nighter or close to. And I found all-nighters stressed me out. I would have panic attacks. So A, I just committed to stop doing all-nighters and let the cards fall as they may. But I started jump roping. I don't know, like in the middle of the night at 3 a.m., you can't just drive to the gym. So I bought a jump rope, and I would just jump rope as fast as I could, as hard as I could, until I was absolutely cyanotic and pale from having no breath. And I found my anxiety would go away for some whatever reason. So you'd find me outside of my house at 3 a.m. sometimes, just jumping rope like a madman, like the next Rocky Balboa, you know what I mean? Just
neighbors are looking out, yeah. Like, what's going on?
And I found that was a quick way that I could just get out of that element. I could get out of that state of panic or anxiety. And I think you just have to find that. Some people, it's through prayer. I think now mine's more through prayer or worship. I'll turn on some kind of worship music and just kind of let my mind drift away and be prayerful and thoughtful in that. And that's not everybody's get out of jail free card. I don't know what yours is, but you got to find that. And failure to find that could be disastrous. I talked about it in small group. I had a really amazing co-resident. He was from Syria. And if you know anything about that area, it's not good, especially when you have family in Syria. I mean, it's just a really bad place right now. A lot of internal conflict, and he was living that. His family was actually in Syria. He had a wife in Syria and a kid in Syria. He came over for the American dream. I don't know. But He was successful. He found himself in a residency in the United States. He found himself as about to be a graduate surgeon and make a lot of money. And his whole plan was getting his family. He was actively working, but it takes a long time. For people that think you can just apply and your family's over in a month, you need to educate yourself. There are classmates amongst you who are, it's sad, undergoing threats of deportation and having to figure out their paperwork and their documentation. It's sad. It's sad. You would be surprised. And I only know this because we have a small group and we ask and we have the tough conversations. But he found himself overwhelmed. And this is a guy I broke bread with multiple times. And obviously he was Muslim. And that doesn't matter. Me and him, we were tight. We had great conversation about faith. If you can't sit there and listen to somebody else's faith without judgment, you got a problem. You are the problem. I'll say that. Be recorded. Re-listen to it. And we would sit there all the time. And I say all this to say, he unfortunately lost his battle with mental health. And he killed himself in residency. And it was so sad. It was so sad. And we have to know that. We have to know that. And I don't want to take a dark turn to this podcast, but we have to know that our risk is higher than the population. We have to know that our friends' risk, the same people that wear these scrubs, risk is higher than the general population. And that's the reason I do small group. So that at least I know in your second year, when it's the hardest. Second year is the hardest year in med school, guys. You get through it downhill. It's fun. It actually becomes fun. I know that's weird. You're like, med school does not equal fun. It is not synonymous with the term fun. But once you get through your second year, it becomes fun. But this is the time to check in on each other. And residency. Residency gets back to not being fun so much because you're working 80-hour weeks. The work is fun. The hours are not fun. But at least for me and my group, my people, right? Those 20 people, I at least know that they have a place where they're getting checked on every week, or at least every week that we have breakout. And that's why I do and lead breakouts the way I do and lead breakouts. And you need to have that group. If you're listening, man, and you feel alone on the island, you are not. You're not. You need to reach out. You need to find that person, your guy, as I say, and talk about it, right? A conversation will go miles to getting you in the right direction.
Yeah, so I think we're about at an hour now, so we can go ahead and wrap this up. Do you have any last words you'd like to say? Any last pieces of advice?
Man, we didn't talk about finances. I thought we were going to get into finances. So oh, yeah. I'm going to spend 5 minutes talking about finances. I love finances. And whoever listens to this, hopefully it's the entire class. Hopefully it's OMS 1 through 4. Hopefully it's beyond this medical school. I think the fact that you guys are doing a podcast in medical school is so good, so needed, and has the potential to impact so many. Because this is becoming the format in which people want to engage, right? Or maybe smaller clips, maybe like a TikTok reel or something like that, which you guys should look into as well. Quick blurbs like that that you can post is also a really good idea, and I think you guys are capable of doing that. I love personal finance, so let me give you the quick Ryan Anderson blurb on finances. You guys likely listening have taken out loans, and those loans are a lot, and they feel like a lot, and they will feel like a lot, and they won't stop feeling like a lot. That's okay. You're not alone on an island. Everybody has a lot of debt. Thankfully, you are going to be in the top earners in the United States. That's awesome. Reward yourself. That is your reward. You're going to go through so much delayed gratification of medical school, internship, residency, whatever you decide, maybe fellowship. And then finally, you're going to get yours. And that's an awesome feeling to finally cash in and obtain your reward. And some of you will go nuts. Don't. Don't. There's somebody I follow, White Coat Investor, Dr. Dolly is his name. Look him up. He's got a book geared for medical students. I can't think of what it's called. He also has the book called White Coat Companion. Buy that book. It'll be the best investment. It'll be better than any medical textbook you ever buy. Even more important than rapid EKG interpretation. All right? What you should do financially now is nothing. But once you're done with medical school, you're going to figure out how to repay these loans. And I want you to look that up. I want you to think about that. They're all income-driven repayment plans of sorts. Now, we just had an election yesterday. So I'm going to say all this, and I'm going to tell you, I don't know how it's going to change. I hypothesize It will change. Right now, payment plans are based off of, this is loose. There's many different types. Look it up. There's easy tables to compare. 10% of your discretionary income, right? 10% of what you make, you're going to be forced to put that towards loans. Okay? A few years ago, last year, year and a half ago, there was a program called the SAVE, S-A-V-E. Listeners, write it down, look it up later. What it did was allow you to repay only 5% of your discretionary income. So your payment plans are halved, okay? So one half of what they used to be. Why does this matter? There's something, these are not the same thing. Hear me now, these are not the same thing. There's something called public service loan forgiveness, okay? It's what you all should try to obtain. You have to work for either a government entity, such as the VA, or a nonprofit entity, which most of your residency programs are going to be not-for-profit, okay? In order for PSLF, you have to do 120 payments, okay? So of that 5%, or of that 10%, depending on which repay, you got to do 120. And as long as you're working for the government or in a nonprofit, after 120, that's 10 years, everything's forgiven, okay? Why does that matter? The SAVE program, if we think about 10 years, 120 payments, forgiven. The SAVE program, 5% of your discretionary income, you'll have the maximum forgiven. Does that make sense? Because you're only paying 5% of your payment, 5% of your discretionary income for 10 years, as opposed to 10% of your discretionary income for 10 years, and you can get the most forgiven. The question is, will this be available to me when I graduate? I don't know. If it is, click SAVE, okay? Every medical student at the sound of my voice should click SAVE, because you can always make more than that payment. You don't have to make minimum payments. Maybe you say, I'm throwing in the towel and I don't want to go to a nonprofit. I want to go to this place and it's not a nonprofit and I won't qualify for PSLF. Fine. What Dr. Dolly says is, he says, live like a resident for 5 years. So as a resident, you'll make $60,000, $70,000, give or take, right around there. If you can transform into your attending hood and live like a resident for 5 years and save all that income, you can do one of two things. You can put it in a savings account. And that way, if you get your loans forgiven, you can just take that money. They're mine. Or if you don't get those loans forgiven, you have a big savings account and you can just put all that into your loans. Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
So in the meantime, you can do nothing. Now, some people are like, well, if I'm going to get maximum forgiven, I'm just going to take out maximum loans. And we've seen that. People have been taking out maximum loans are like, I'm just going to go for forgiveness. I'm okay working for a nonprofit. I'm okay working for a government entity for 10 years. Maybe, maybe not. You'll get a lot of money forgiven. But maybe you don't want to, I mean, maybe you desire to live next to home and it's a nonprofit. You can't really predict your future, but you can set yourself up for success in the future, right? As a residency program, it's okay. I'll forgive you all for being late. As a residency program, one of my things, I've talked about this in small group, how do you pick residency programs? We need a part two to this podcast. As a residency program, what I did is I just made a list of values that was important to me. Some of them were important, some of them were trivial, okay? I wanted to go to a place, I went to ER, you know, I went to emergency medicine residency. So one of my priorities was having a level one trauma center in-house. I wanted to go to the big academic center where I was gonna see everything. One of those was a match. I wanted a 401k in which the hospital offered a match, right? One of those was, I want free food if I'm on call. And I said, it's trivial, but if I'm going to be on call for you, you should pay for my meal. If I'm going to be here for 24 hours, I shouldn't have to pay for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So whatever your thing is. Some people put, I want a free gym subscription. You know, some of the people's lists alter based off of what your important things are. And I can't tell you what your important things are. You have to figure that out. And then as I was interviewing me, I was essentially interviewing them to see how many check boxes they met. So that's something to look out for when you choose residency. Do they offer a 401k? So that's a retirement account, right? So 401k, 403b. 403b is going to be your nonprofit if you are going for public service loan forgiveness. It's the same thing. Military, TSP, it's all the same thing. And then an IRA. So my challenge to you listeners, a Roth IRA. You can open them up at every major financial company, Vanguard, Fidelity, whatever. I can't think of any others because those are the ones I use. In residency, try to commit to maxing out your IRA. It's about, what was it this year? 7,000? I obviously didn't prepare these numbers. I think it's 7,000 this year. I already maxed mine. I maxed mine at the beginning of the year. But commit to saving $7,000 in a Roth IRA. If you can do that, the compound interest that you will receive when that thing's been in there over your maybe 20, 30 year career is going to be massive. So that would be my challenge. In residency, try to max out an IRA. And that $70,000 that you make, try to commit $7,000 and just put it in a Roth IRA. Because that down the road is gonna reap dividends. And all of that is in the White Coat Companion. So buy that book, read that book, and we'll sign off here. Awesome. And I'll just say thank you so much for having me here.
Yes, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day, talking to us about finances, family, just everything we've talked about today. We greatly appreciate it. And to everyone listening, thank you for taking time out of your day to listen to us sit here and talk and share the podcast with all your friends. This is us signing off from the Do It Right podcast.